Sky News Centre at 5. Three people have been killed after a truck was driven into a crowd in Stockholm. It then ploughed into a department store in the city's busiest shopping area. The main railway station and subway have been closed over reports the suspect ran towards an underground station. Here's Sweden's Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven.
Sweden has been attacked. Everything indicates that this is a terrorist act. The government is obviously being updated all the time. The government is doing everything to support the authorities. We urge the public to be alert and listen to police.
The Foreign Office says British nationals should stay away from public areas. A Romanian tourist who fell into the Thames during the Westminster terror attack has died from her injuries. 31-year-old Andrea Cristea was on holiday with her boyfriend, who'd planned to propose later that day. Russia says America's missile strike on a Syrian airbase was an act of aggression. President Trump ordered the operation in response to a gas attack on civilians in which 80 people died. The Defence Secretary, Sir Michael Fallon's, backed the action, but Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn thinks it shouldn't have taken place without UN approval.
I think it is the wrong time to do it. I think they should have been in consultation with the UN before anything happened, but it has happened. Let's now have rapid ceasefire and a return to the negotiating table in Geneva.
A cricketer spared a prison term 2 weeks ago for domestic violence has been jailed for 18 months. Mustafa Bashir, who's 33 and from Greater Manchester, falsely claimed he'd lose a job to play professionally if he was jailed. The European Commission's approved the planned takeover of Sky by 21st Century Fox. It's reviewed the £11.7 billion deal and says there are no competition concerns. In sport, Great Britain are struggling in their Davis Cup tennis quarter-final away to France. Dan Evans is a set down to Jeremy Chardy in the second match. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
BCFM with a real deal.
With BCFM.
We won't let you down.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for Lockleys, Esther Ticknell. After the 6 o'clock news, Donald Trump bombs the Syrian government's Shayarat airbase near Homs in Syria. So what's the evidence that Assad is behind Tuesday's chemical weapons attack? And why is he providing, Trump that is, air support for ISIS? Another apparent car attacker also in Stockholm today. Three people are dead, but is it an accident? Almost forgotten in all of this is Russia's first terror attack since Volgograd in 2013. On Monday, that's in the St. Petersburg metro, which killed double the number of those that died in London a couple of weeks ago. Yes, and what about that Westminster Bridge attack? Alan Buttle's a Londoner who's livid about the media coverage of the Khalid Masood incident. Why is he so annoyed? Well, we take a closer look at all that's emerged about the Wednesday, the 22nd of March attack since it dropped out of the headlines. Plus, when looking at modern events through the media, it's your truth, my truth, his truth and her truth, isn't it? Whatever happened to objective truth, though? Indian writer Ravi Zacharias believes there's a deliberate plan to bring us to the point where ancient ideas about right and wrong can be torn up and remoulded in a day where people will stop trusting their instincts and their own assessment of truth. And he doesn't have a lot of time for philosophers. Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry this weekend, highs of 21 degrees. Sunny on Saturday, mostly sunny as well on Sunday. Lovely. Next week, highs around 14, feeling colder but still lots of sunshine. Next weekend, that's the 15th and the 16th of April, that's Easter Day and Easter Monday. Highs of 14 degrees Celsius and a fairly sunny Easter. That's lovely, isn't it? What good news. It's nice to be back. I seem to have missed the tail end of winter, which was lovely. Must do that again sometime on my holiday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Labour Councillor for Lockleys, Estella Ticknor. Hi, Estella.
Hello.
Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank
now,
you.
Estella, you've been a councillor for a couple of years now, I haven't actually had you on the radio. I feel I should have invited you a bit earlier. So tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your daytime job?
My daytime job is I actually lecture in film studies at University of the West of England, and I've just come from there today. Been teaching students about film today. So last day of term, they're all breaking up to go home for Easter, and I had to assess some presentations this afternoon.
Tell us a bit about that. That sounds a fascinating thing. What about, is this documentary film, feature films, short films? What?
It's a mixture, actually. I've been teaching students a module called Cultural Value, which is all about how we assess the value of things like film and television and the kind of hierarchies there are. For example, television normally has a much lower cultural value than film. There's no good reason for it other than the fact that it's associated with domesticity, with women, and people often ascribe much higher value to film than they do to television programmes. And television programmes are often rewarded for looking cinematic. So if they're shot on film, using expensive locations, a particular kind of cast, and people say they're better. They aren't necessarily intrinsically better.
Now listen, you're a real expert on this topic, doing a lecture in it. So
I can see I'm fascinating you.
give us a couple of your favourite filmmakers, documentary makers, directors. Who's the cream of the crop?
Of course, it is in some way subjective, except that there are really hierarchies around who's seen as good and who's not seen as good. One of my own personal favourite filmmakers is a filmmaker called Jane Campion, who comes from New Zealand. Her most famous film is called The Piano, released some time ago now, in 1993, a kind of melodrama set in the 1840s in New Zealand, in New Zealand bush. Very dark, very harrowing film, very complex film, but uses music beautifully. And one of my other research interests is the relationship between music and film. So I do teach a level 3 module on that called Music, Cinema, Culture, which covers everything from film scores to the soundtrack movie to the way in which music has changed in film and looking at sound effects as well.
Now, there's a New Zealand film industry. I mean, I've just come back from spending a couple of weeks over there. Absolutely gorgeous country.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know quite what else to say.
Absolutely.
You look at the place and you think, you know, we've actually managed to get on. I mean, obviously there were colonial wars with the Maoris, but the Maoris have kind of revenge in a way, because what they've done is they've done all these land claims from hundreds of years ago, and they've been very successful in claiming money from the New Zealand government for land. They've used that land, they've hired a load of white management school trained people to invest that money in lots of the tourist attractions and things like that, actually Maori owned. So they've done quite well, I think, much better than the Australians with the Aborigines in actually having a good relationship.
Major difference. First of all, the Maori are not native to New Zealand. They too were migrants.
But they were there
when
we turned up. When Captain Cook turned up.
They arrived about the same time we were building Westminster Abbey. But they weren't indigenous peoples. But what's interesting, you're right, they're very warlike, and there are major battles between the Brits primarily and the Maori, which are eventually resolved in the Treaty of Waitangi in 1844, when they agreed to kind of live separate lives and to kind of come to an agreement about how they'd rub along together. And New Zealand is very proud of what it calls its biculturalism, which is that both Maori and white people share all the kind of major institutions, the culture. Most white people learn Maori language. So it's a really interesting example of people actually choosing to get along together without the kind of racial conflict that, as you rightly say, ended in tragedy in many ways for Aborigines in Australia. And of course Native Americans too were subject to forms of genocide by white settlers.
Amazing. And also the film industry there, very good. I mean, they seem to have a different culture in New Zealand, which is not the fear of your boss. You don't have fear of your boss. If you don't like your boss, you just leave and you get another job. A bit like maybe it was like here, certainly if you talk to older people back in the 1960s and 70s, you know, where it was actually relatively easy to get a new job if you didn't get on with your boss.
When New Zealand was settled in the 19th century, and especially in the 20th century, there was a really strong commitment to kind of egalitarianism and the idea that nobody was better than anybody else. You know, the whole thing about tall poppies, it was like everyone's equal, everyone has a right to be here. And I think that's a really kind of refreshing openness to the culture there. But yes, when you come back to the UK, I think you do notice things like class differences.
It's also that over here, every square inch seems to be tied down and owned by somebody. And if you want to get hold of somewhere to live, it's almost impossible. Over there, they have this thing called sections where you just buy a section and they're not expensive.
Yeah.
You put a house on it. You buy a little, a mobile home to start with.
That's
then you
right.
can build your own place.
You can have your mobile home on the road, which is very much a New Zealand thing, isn't it? You know, the
well, they
the
do that too,
vans.
Yeah. which is, and they've got these kind of picnic areas set up just for camper vans.
That's
you
right.
drive in there
That's
and
right.
spend the night, and it's all for free.
And
amazing.
Your batch, you know, the batch, which is a little kind of shack people build on the beach or out in the countryside.
You know more about New Zealand than I do. I should have had a guided tour from you. Anyway, look, there's also the film industry over there.
Yes.
An amazing film just out. I don't know if you've seen it, Estella, called Hunt for the Wilder People with Sam Neill. I was really hoping to see this on New Zealand Airways on the flights, you know, and nothing. But this is well worth watching, folks. Everyone was telling me over there, you must see it.
I know.
Sam Neill's a great actor, of course.
Sam Neill is a real ambassador for New Zealand film. He's a great actor. He actually appeared in Piano, the one I mentioned earlier on. And you're absolutely right about the New Zealand film industry, but it's changed radically since Peter Jackson, really. You know, the whole trilogy that Peter Jackson made, the Tolkien trilogies and the Hobbit films, have really transformed the landscape, almost literally, in New Zealand for filmmaking.
And also Riley Ace of Spies, I remember him before, which was made in the 1980s.
Yes, early 80s, I do remember him.
Houston Films, folks. Yes. They really could make films in those days. Not like the most of the rubbish you see on the cinemas today. Anyway, look.
I can't comment on that.
tell us a little bit about Loch Lees, because that's where you're representing.
Yes.
It's one of those little parts of Bristol which is kind of a bit out on a limb, isn't it?
Yes, and in fact a lot of people say, where is Loch Lees? And Loch Lees people do sometimes feel that they're a bit forgotten.
Well, you drive up the M32, look left, if you can see a little tower, that's Loch Lees.
That's right. Yes, on Purdown, you've got the Purdown Telecom Tower, which I always think of looks a bit like a pagoda. And Loch Lees has got amazing green space. Stoke Park, Purdown turns into Stoke Park. If you carry on northwest, heading to South Gloucestershire, it's a really wonderful space. And we've got a great local guy called Steve England, who you may have heard of. He writes for the local press. He's very well known as a kind of naturalist and teacher. And Steve knows everything there is to know about Stoke Park, about its natural history, about its heritage, its archaeology. And he sort of introduced me and my co-councillor Jill to Stoke Park, told us all about it. He does wonderful walks out there. So it's a real jewel in the crown of Loch Lees, but also for Bristol, that people know about the Downs. They don't really know about Stoke Park.
Okay, well, getting down to earth a little bit, one of the
Can
real problems.
Can I just tell you a story about Stoke Park?
Go on then, go for it.
To do with a metro bus, now, which is quite a contentious issue, of course, because the metro bus goes past my ward. It doesn't actually stop in my ward, which is a bit of a bone of contention for me. But when a lot of the working was going on earlier on this year, they put some strong fencing up, and two deer were trapped there. Poor Mark Bradshaw, the cabinet member for transport, was being pilloried in the local press, but it was all his fault because he was supposed to be in charge of Metro Bus. And they couldn't get the deer out. They wouldn't move. Now, I'm pleased to say that finally we've had some deer handling experts from Ashton Court.
So they weren't shot and sold?
No, certainly not, no. In fact, the female deer was pregnant. So Steve was quite concerned about them because they were quite frightened and they were sort of trapped between the fencing and the hedges. We've had a deer handler from Ashton Court come up, I think today, because Steve texted me to say that the deer have been freed, so all is well. So I'm pleased about that.
Metro bus, look, this is causing far more traffic jams than it's ever going to solve, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that. I know that it's pretty horrendous in the city centre at the moment. They've just reconfigured the city centre, actually, to accommodate the building that's
been
done.
It's caused loads more today.
Yes.
I mean, this has been going on for over a year.
Yeah.
It's going to carry on as well. To be honest, it sounds to me like a total waste of money.
Well,
putting money into something which is going to, yes, it's going to help some people in certain parts of the city get in and out and commute, etc.
Yeah.
But the disruption that it's caused has been horrendous.
It's really been a challenge.
I mean, you're weighing
that
it in the scales,
sure.
aren't you? The disruption caused now is somewhere in the scales.
And the future is...
Yeah.
So what do you do? You have to resolve that somehow. Metrobus is intended to enable the commute to be much better and to ease congestion in and out of the north and south of the city. Of course, the problem we've got is that Bristol actually has very narrow roads, so any kind of roadworks will have a knock-on effect. And it also has incredibly high car use. We've got something like
the
largest
for that
number
is
of
because
cars
the public,
the population in the country.
The public transport is appalling here. That's why we've got so... If there was a decent, sensible system, like in somewhere like London, for example, which has got a decent reasonable network. I mean, you know, you're cramming in cyclists with cars. We've just heard today, by the way, cyclist Sam Crowe is, I'm just looking at the Bristol Post, is continuing his fight for life after a Gloucester Road hit and run. You know, what we're trying to do is cram everybody into the same place. We're telling people to go use their bikes, but then things like this happen.
I know. It's really difficult, that's for sure. But I would also say that Bristol has quite narrow roads. So what do you do to resolve that? Do you knock houses down? Which is what cities like Birmingham did in the 1960s, very controversially, built very large ring roads, which were themselves quite unpopular. And the argument was then that they simply attracted more traffic.
Well, how about a municipal transport company that just does it, plans it right from the top down?
Well, one of the things about a metro mayor, actually, is that we're going to have to try and resolve some of these questions in a larger kind of envelope than the city.
But we had the Bristol Omnibus Company all those years ago.
Know,
we didn't have a metro mayor then. It worked fine.
If it were my gift, I'd do it now, but it's not. We're not empowered to do so.
All the industries that there were in Bristol, people, you know, moving people around the city, it was a hell of a task back in the 1950s.
But there were far fewer people having in cars in the 1960s and 70s. So Bristol is in some ways a bit of a victim of its own success. It's quite an affluent city. As I said before, it's got something like more cars per head of population than any other equivalent city in the country, and as you rightly say, we have not got good public transport links. Everyone jumps in their car or they go on their bike.
Still, while I was away, Bristol was named as the best place to live in Britain.
It was,
in 2017.
Despite all that.
I know. The city's named as the UK's most desirable location in the Sunday Times, if you believe the Rupert Murdoch Press. Best places to live guide described as a small city that feels like a big city. Well, I must admit, that was rather like that when I first came here back in the mid 1990s. You know, it was a sort of village atmosphere almost, even in the city centre.
Yes, it has. And can I say, as I'm a culture lead, I can bring in my own responsibility here. Bristol's culture is a really important aspect of that. And it isn't just like the big institutions and organisations and venues. They're important. Places like Watershed, I think, are great, you know, because it isn't just a cinema or a media centre. It's somewhere people go in, they work, they have coffee, they talk. But it's also the kind of culture of a city in terms of people's sense of identity and the fact that it's a kind of can-do city and a do-it-yourself city. So, you know, hence things like, you know, people like Banksy, for example. We've got amazing street art in Bristol. And that is about kind of grassroots up culture, not just kind of top-down culture. And it makes Bristol a really interesting and exciting place.
Don't you think street art flourishes when the mainstream media is doing a bad job, is not really, you know, reflecting what ordinary people are thinking, and young people particularly?
I think street art does flourish when there are major issues at stake, yes. I think commentary is a really valuable part of street art, actually, drawing attention to issues and to things that we maybe take for granted. And in fact, at the moment, I'm just working on a project to encourage more street art. Not, I hasten to add, where people don't want it, but where people do want it, where it's attractive, where it's a genuine contribution to the environment, in enhancing the environment. And I'm quite excited about the idea that we might have, for example, murals, you know, capturing aspects of Bristol's life, different parts of the city, sort of showing the people who live and work there and the things which are important to them.
Ryanair also have announced this week that they could halt flights from Bristol over Brexit uncertainty. Which camp are you in on the Brexit or remaining?
I voted Remain. Quite concerned. Yeah. Well, I'm very concerned about the impact of Brexit on Bristol in particular. An awful lot of the money in Bristol does depend on our relationship with the European Union. We have two universities which have strong research links. We have aerospace. All of those are part of the lifeblood of the city. And more widely, I'm also you just mentioned Ryanair. For example, things like the negotiations for links with the airport will become extremely complex. At the moment, we have what's called an open skies agreement with the European Union. Once that disappears, Bristol Airport will have to negotiate 52 different contracts and agreements with airlines in order to allow them to come and go from Bristol
Airport.
Well,
of course, they always did do that before.
If you multiply that with all the other kind of negotiations that have to go on, this is a really challenging situation we're going to be facing.
There's quite a lot of people who are really still campaigning for Remain. Do you think it's going to be possible to stop Brexit? We've still got 2 years before it actually happens, apparently.
At the moment, I think that the people have spoken, and that the government is broadly right to continue to do it because we've had a referendum. You can't keep having referendums until people get the right answer, in inverted commas. And I think also that there is a very strong anti-European feeling in the country, which is tied in to the way in which people have felt marginalised and excluded by growing disparities of wealth, for example, in the UK over the last 10 years, a sense that people didn't no longer the kind of jobs available for people that they needed. And my own ward of Lotleys has been badly hit by those kinds of things. It used to be an area where there were kind of skilled workers who did work in places like aerospace. Now those kinds of jobs are primarily graduate jobs, and many people get excluded from that. And I can understand the feeling that somehow the economy and society has somehow left you behind, and people were quite angry about that.
It's not quite right to call it the Europe, is it? Because it's really the EU.
The
and it's
EU,
Brussels.
Yeah.
Brussels.
We're not leaving Europe, no.
Brussels,
right.
That, you know, having the
right.
idea
yeah.
of Britain sort of floating out across the Atlantic.
Yeah.
But isn't it mainly to do with the cheap labour that's been brought in? I mean, it's almost as if we started off with an agreement in the common market to move goods around, and we're now at the point where we're almost treating people as goods, where people can move around wherever they want, and there's no restriction, and that has led to effectively to driving down wages and importing of a lot of cheap labour. We're now at something like 330,000 people a year coming into Britain from other parts of Europe, and they're mostly doing it put quite rightly for economic reasons, because they can get work here, they can get paid a lot more here than they would be in their own home countries.
I think there has been an exploitation of migrant labour, and I think that's really problematic. I think everyone should be paid a decent wage, a decent living wage. But conversely, the free movement of people's around the European Union has benefited many Britons, not only young people working in places like France and Germany, but I myself have an uncle and aunt who moved to Spain. They can take their British pension there. They're living quite well. They're quite worried now about what's going to happen. We have very significant numbers of Britons living in the south of France, Spain, Portugal, all those hot countries, and that's been enabled by the European movement of people around the European Union.
So you don't see it as a United States of Europe, or do you?
No, I don't see it in those terms. I think actually that much of the legislation introduced by the European Union has been extremely useful in protecting things like workers' rights, animal rights, for example. I think that's actually been good. And I think that in a dangerous global world, as we see from what's been happening in Syria, that the European Union, although it is absolutely not perfect, and there is no doubt at all that it was excessively bureaucratic, that I would agree with. But generally speaking, I think it's been a force for good.
But I think Martin would probably agree with you when you say it's a dangerous world, particularly with regards to Syria, Martin.
Well, yes, and I mean, obviously, I was a Remainer as well. I think the thing about migrant labour, people have got to realise that most of the people coming here are young people who are paying in to the into the tax system.
But for every one person that's paying in, there's another person that's not, isn't there?
Well, the fact is, Tony, that the people coming here to work, in terms of, and there may be, there is an issue about them forcing down the wages of people, that they're in competition with. But in terms of the fiscal impact, it's all positive. And when all of these people go, we're going to find a hole in the budget, because these people are all... Don't forget, they're young, they're not actually using up NHS resources very much, they're paying in.
This is a basic bit of logic. Surely if you're displacing another worker, you're coming in...
No, because that's...
Just a minute, let me finish what I'm saying, Martin. If you're displacing another worker, that other worker is then going to be claiming benefits for a short period of time or a long period of time. There's at the moment, any one time, there's a finite number of jobs out there, and if... surely this is just
actually,
basic...
Can I answer that? There isn't a finite number of jobs. As an economist, I have to tell you, there isn't a finite number of jobs.
Is there an infinite number of jobs?
No, there isn't. The number of jobs you have depends on how fast your economy is growing, which depends upon the age profile of the people you've got.
Extremely slow right now, isn't it?
Well,
we've had a global recession.
It's not extremely slow. What's happened after Brexit? Everybody says that there hasn't been a crash. That's because we took another QE, a big E, and we're all feeling pretty happy about that. The property market's still going, because Mark Carney gave us all a pill. But of course that pill's going to wear off. And when it does wear off, the crash isn't going to come because of Brexit. The crash is going to come because the banking system shot to pieces.
Estella, what do you make of this sort of more macroeconomic? Do you actually think about that sort of stuff, from a much wider point of view? The euro, the long-term plan?
I agree. with Martin. Beg your pardon, I do know Martin. Sorry, I broadly agree with what Martin just pointed out about the economy. Economies are not kind of fixed at a certain size. I mean, that would be ridiculous. Otherwise, America couldn't have become one of the largest economies in the globe, and Britain couldn't have become an empire. Economies grow, and they grow in quite complex ways. So there's not a finite number of jobs. We actually create jobs. Now, one of the problems we've had, of course, in the UK is we've probably become overdependent.
Well, we haven't been creating jobs here, have we? We've been getting rid of them for the last 20 years or so.
We've been overdependent on the City of London and financial institutions to drive our economy. But what that has also done, it's sucked in employment to London while the rest of the country is actually in some way stagnated. Now, Bristol's unusual. Bristol's actually a relatively thriving city compared to many of the cities in the north and in the Midlands. But what we need to do, I think, is to find ways in which London does not dominate the economy in a way that it has done for the last 20 years.
What about decisions from the EU, like, for example, just I think it was just like a week or so ago, firms now can ban workers from wearing headscarves and other religious symbols under a new EU ruling. In its first ruling on headscarves at work, the European Court of Justice has backed bans on religious symbols, but only if they cover all religions equally. Now, this does make it easier for bosses to simply sack somebody because they're wearing a religious symbol at work. I mean, a headscarf, for example.
I have no problem with people wearing a crucifix, for example, around their neck, wearing a turban if they're a
Sikh. What about a headscarf?
I have absolutely no problem.
The EU is saying if you're a boss and you don't like one of your workers wearing a headscarf, you can sack them.
I'd like to see what that actually said.
Well, it's in the Daily Mirror. I'll put a link up on our show page. Firms, I tell you, the headline is firms can ban workers from wearing headscarves and other religious symbols under a new EU ruling. In its first ruling on headscarves at work, the European Court of Justice has backed bans on religious symbols. I mean, this to me sounds like a regressive step.
Yes,
I mean, it makes me want to come into BCFM wearing a headscarf, seeing things like that. Martin, what do you make of this ruling?
Well, leaving aside the EU provenance of it, it's unacceptable and it doesn't really fit in the way we approach these things in this country. I mean, look at the ban on the full face burkas in France and so on. I don't think that would be acceptable in Britain.
How come it's happened in France and not here?
Because you've got the history of the war in Algeria, the fact that they've got a large Muslim minority that fled at the end of the war, and of course if the National Front win the election later in this year, then we could have civil war on the streets of France, because it happened before. Hundreds of people died in the Paris metro in the 1950s, killed by the police.
Don't forget, France is officially a secular country.
Yeah.
Britain has a slightly more muddled, classic British compromise.
But can't you be a secular?
We have a head of state who's also the head of the church.
I know, but
we tend to kind of compromise on these things.
You could be a secular headscarf wearer, can't you? If you're secular, you can wear a headscarf if you
wish to. I think it's ridiculous, illiberal and ridiculous. I would certainly not tolerate that, no.
I just was quite surprised.
And in fact, until 50 years ago, women wore headscarves in Western Europe as a matter of course.
The Queen.
It was a standard form of dress. Yeah. That's what's extraordinary now, is that women are actually being pilloried for wearing an item of clothing that in Europe was standard dress until 50 years ago.
A documentary has revealed this week how nothing has changed for the city's housing crisis since Cathy Come Home. Today's families apparently are facing the same situations that shocked the nation, revealed in Ken Loach's landmark 1966 drama. Martin, I mean, this housing business just seems to be a complete bugbear in this city and in many other parts of the country. For young people, you talk to young people. I was chatting to a young chap the other day. He's got absolutely no chance of buying a house, starting, and worries about even being able to start a family, because it's just impossible to get your foot on the bottom rung of the ladder, almost even getting social housing, but certainly not being able to buy your own home.
Well, the real problem is you can't get on the housing ladder, you can't get social housing, and increasingly because of universal credit, you can't get private housing either. And of course, this housing shortage is nothing to do with the EU. It's the absurd obsession with property ownership, which various Tory governments have been have driven, and New Labour did nothing about in 13 years in power. And that, of course, then leads people to say the immigrants are getting the housing or whatever. There should be housing for everybody, and there isn't. And, of course, then they say, oh, it's the immigrants. And the problem is the housing.
I stopped in Singapore on the way back from Auckland, and I was amazed to hear there 80% of people in Singapore live in government-provided housing. Yeah. They have virtually no homelessness at all. Yeah. In a place like Singapore, you know, in Asia, they can manage this, but we can't here in Bristol, yeah. Stella.
Well, it is one of the unforeseen consequences of the property-owning democracy, isn't it? You know, one of the problems we had was that under Thatcher, people were allowed to buy their council houses, but the money was not allowed to be used to replace council housing with more council housing.
So what are you and your party going to do about it?
As you know, it's our top priority. And one of the things we have been busy doing behind the scenes, because it takes a while to make these things happen, but we have two major designated areas for new housing in Bristol. One is Hengrove and one is Lot Lees. And I know from my own experience as a ward councillor that we have brownfield sites in Lot Lees which have been sitting empty for several years. People ask me when I go knocking on their door, what are you going to do about houses? And I understand only too well that we have an emergent or resurgence of overcrowding. Several generations living in one house, and that is not acceptable in a modern civilised country. So one of the things we're going to be doing is building more houses in the Lot Lees area and the Hengrove area, and it will include a significant proportion of affordable housing and social housing.
Is that a promise?
Yes. It's happening.
So when? I've just been doing this show for whatever, is it 8 years or something now, and people keep saying, yes, we're going to build housing, yes, and it doesn't really
happen. First of all, you had several years of George Ferguson, who absolutely did not do anything about the housing crisis. One of the first things we did, as soon as we entered office last May, was to actually call in the officers who are responsible for housing and say, right, this is the new policy, now we need you to get on with it, and that's what they're doing. And it does take a while, because some of this is about scoping out the actual availability of the land, putting it, market testing it. I know that sounds as though we're making excuses, but I can promise you real things are happening, and it will take a couple of years for, you know, shovels to hit the land, but that's partly to do with the way in which the wider economic context is working. But we're definitely going to be building houses.
Well, have we ended up with a situation like in Finsel's Reach in the city centre opposite Castle Park, where there's a beautiful housing scheme been built there? I mean, actually the first company that started building it went bust, and someone else had to pick up the reins, and yet still places are unsold. You know, we've got empty, brand new places, and yet we've got still people sleeping on the streets.
I know. Well, don't forget that development was put in train before we came into power. And I agree, it's completely unacceptable that you have luxury flats being built in a city centre and yet people are desperate for housing in other parts of the city.
Is it possible, Martin, to actually get governments and local authorities serious about getting engaged with this? Because it's something everybody needs, and it's a very basic... I mean, it's almost like the starting point to having a thriving and successful city or a thriving and successful country, to make sure everyone's got a roof over their head.
Well,
can't they even sort that out?
Also, the macroeconomic impacts of having property bubbles which burst are... That's why we've deindustrialised. It's because we've concentrated on building conservatories instead of better widgets.
Is it because housing is a safe bet for investment rather than industry or something?
No, the history goes back to the 1920s, when housing was given particular, you know, buying your own house was given tax relief, because the Tories at the time thought if we can get them buying their own houses, they won't be able to go on strike and they're more likely to vote Tory. And of course, that's what's ultimately happened. And of course, selling off council houses at less than the market value, that means that the people concerned made a huge capital gain in a place like Bristol.
Yes,
and that capital gain is that money. We've got a deficit now. We've got to cut to nursery schools and primary schools and hospitals because we haven't got any money. But we gave away millions to certain people, and those people have then sold them on, and those what used to be council houses are now coming back onto the market as buy-to-let private housing at much, much higher rents.
So when is this bubble?
So
where is
that's
this
one of the biggest problems in my... Well, it's an emerging problem in my ward, but what were council houses, family council houses, have been sold to private landlords, and of course that's difficult to stop, who then subdivide them into, you know, several rooms. You've got six or seven students living there, all being charged a couple of hundred pounds a month, and yet people are desperately in need of proper housing. So it's a fundamental contradiction.
Just hearing today, UK house price growth is the weakest since 2013. Well, I think they're gilding the lily. They're gilding the lily there because actually, I've been reading some reports saying house prices are actually going down in some areas. Halifax Property Market Index is saying it's the weakest since 2013. So, what's the consequence of actually hitting the ceiling of house prices, Martin?
Well, it doesn't just stay as it is. The problem with property price collapses is it falls down a hole. And of course, it's not just the property bubble in Britain.
Is it a matter of confidence or something?
It's partly a matter of confidence, ultimately, yes. I mean, but in properly managed countries in Scandinavia, house prices don't move at all. I mean, in Germany, they hardly move over generations. Everybody knows where they stand. Nobody thinks of investing in a house as a way to make money. And if you go to posh dinner parties in Germany or Scandinavia, people talk about what business ideas they've got, not what house prices are doing. The obsession with house prices in Britain is unique, and it also causes unique problems both socially and economically. And we need to just get back to building social housing, and of course we've got a huge backlog to make up. But of course the real problem locally is it doesn't matter what the local Labour Council, and we've got an all-party administration, including the Conservatives here, the problem is central government doesn't want to change the policy. Because the voters under the first-past-the-post system in places like Nuneaton and all the rest of it, these swing voters are the ones that they're trying to bribe by pushing their property values
up. Can I just add to that, though? I think actually, that attitudes are changing. And what's really interesting is that you're quite right to suggest that for the last 20 years, really, a lot of middle-class voters, especially who'd really benefited or perceive themselves as benefiting from the rise in property prices, did not see housing as a major issue. And in fact, it used to be quite difficult to get it onto the agenda, even within the Labour Party. Because people didn't quite notice what had happened. What's happened in the last few years is that middle-class parents have noticed their own children cannot get somewhere to live. And you alluded to this yourself, Tony. So what that means then is it has a knock-on effect in that you can't start a life, as it were. You can't get into a relationship very easily. You can't have a family. You can't plan for the future if you don't have a stable home. So at last, I think, the middle-class voters are beginning to notice that this is hitting them as well as everybody else. And so I think there's a shift in perception, which is why we're finding the Tory government is beginning to ask questions about how we ensure we build more houses.
As Sajid Javid says, the housing market is broke.
Yeah,
but I think the problem is that having gone down the road we've gone down over the last 30 years, the only thing to happen now is at a certain point the property market will collapse. I've seen several of these Tory housing bubbles collapse in my lifetime. I'm 57. This will be exactly the same as the others. And at that point, the middle class who thought they were making money start to lose money, and then they start to wonder what the hell's going on.
Well, housing, I think, is always going to be. Almost every week we're talking about that on this show. And there's also a local resident, well, say local, from Chippenham, Ken Loach, who's... he won the BAFTA, and I was quite hoping to see one of his films on the plane on the way over as well. You know, but like Daniel Blake.
I've seen Ken Loach films on planes.
I think you should do. Why not? It's won the BAFTA, for goodness sake. Anyway, we haven't heard from... I mean, this is just before I went away this all happened. But we haven't actually heard Ken Loach's acceptance speech for him winning the BAFTA for I, Daniel Blake. So let's have a listen to that now.
Thank you to the Academy for endorsing the truth of what the film says, which hundreds of thousands of people in this country know, and that is that the most vulnerable and the poorest people are treated by this government with a callous brutality that is disgraceful. And it's a brutality that extends to keeping out refugee children that we promised to help, and that's a disgrace too. But films can do many things. They can entertain, they can terrify, they can take us to worlds of the imagination, they can make us laugh, and they can tell us something about the real world we live in. And in that real world, it's a bit early for political speech, I'm sorry. but in that real world, it's getting darker, as we know. And in the struggle that's coming between the rich and the powerful, the wealth and the privileged, and the big corporations and the politicians who speak for them on the one hand, and the rest of us on the other, then filmmakers, and we're all filmmakers here, The filmmakers know which side they're on. And despite the glitz and the glamour of occasions like this, we're with the people. Thanks for this.
That's Ken Loach speaking back in February as he's accepted his BAFTA for I, Daniel Blake. This week, the five Tory benefit cuts taking force this week that could affect you in the Daily Mirror, Martin. You've probably forgotten, but a barrage of welfare cuts are about to hit in 2017, and it's the poorest who will lose out. Here's everything you need to know, the Mirror says, and I'll put a link to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, this is the 1st of April, a new financial year, a new load of benefit cuts.
Indeed, and of course, what the ultimately, of course, cutting benefits for people at the bottom actually has a macroeconomic implication because you're actually cutting effective demand. Reducing inheritance tax for the people at the top does nothing to boost effective demand. And of course, there's no case whatsoever in my mind for cutting taxes for the wealthiest people in the society while you're claiming that you've got to cut benefits and others for the poorest people because there's no money. And of course the reason they're able to get away with this, coming back to the electoral system, is if you want to win elections in Britain, you have to win certain swing constituencies, mostly in the commuter towns around London, and therefore house prices are crucial. And also, of course, the demographic is the sort of people they like. There's actually a substantial section of the population that likes the idea that poor people are having a hard time. Read your Dickens, it's all there. And of course the electoral system actually encourages this kind of divide and rule, but of course in Northern Ireland and Scotland and Wales that electoral system's already gone, which is why they're possibly leaving the United Kingdom.
Well, I ought to just run through these changes just in case they catch you off guard. The tax credit to child limit, about 500,000 parents will be hit by 2020 by this change. Then there's the end of the family element. That is, there used to be an extra £545 a year on the table for poorer families. That won't be happening anymore. Also, the £30 a week disability benefit cut, that's kicking in this week. Young people blocked from getting housing benefit. That charity has warned that stopping housing benefit will put thousands on the streets. And changes also for people who've been widowed. Some will gain from the changes to bereavement benefits, but most are set to lose. So this is a whole swathe of changes. And I suppose the government will say, well, you know, we've just got to balance the books. Simple as that, Estella.
I think they're brutal, actually, and it's extremely concerning, especially since as a local authority we're also in a situation where we're having to make cuts we do not want to make, and it is always the poorest who are affected by those things.
Why aren't you and the mayor making more of a fuss
we
about
are.
This?
We're making a big fuss, actually. We've made a very big fuss. But at the end of the day, we don't run the government. And as you also know, we cannot set an illegal budget. If we do, we'll all be looking at you out of the prison bars. So we have to make some choices. They're very, very difficult choices. And I certainly didn't come into politics to make cuts. That's the last thing I wanted to do. What I do want to do is to find ways in which we protect those who are already the most vulnerable and the poorest in our society. And we've tried to ensure that we have protected those services which support those people, but it has not been easy.
Martin, is there any sign that that there is some sort of sensible arrangement with the benefit system whereby at least people can know that they're going to have enough money to feed themselves? I mean, we've got so many on food banks, etc. now. Do basic things like pay for basic things like, you know, even toilet paper, things like that. Some people have just got no money for that.
Well, the answer is no. And I think the fact is that these people are concentrated, like the chap that you had on from Merthyr Tydfil, who was in exactly the same position as the Daniel Blake in the film, whereby his doctor had told him that he wasn't to work because he was too ill to work, but some ATOS bureaucrat, a low-level bureaucrat, decided that he was. So he'd been cut off all help.
Yeah, we found back in February, by the way, that they've finally given him his benefits all the way back for 3 or 4 months as well.
But I mean, the problem is that these people are concentrated, the people who are losing are concentrated in the inner cities and in other places like that, and the electoral system doesn't give those people any leverage. to win general elections in Britain, you have to win swing constituencies in the southeast of England, and the key places like Basildon, Basingstoke, Nuneaton. And the key demographic that decides it are the people who are most exposed to Murdoch media propaganda about benefits, etc. And therefore, it becomes very difficult to defend those people, because they are, even if they all voted Labour, and many of them don't, because of course if you're a young person without a home, you're not going to be able to register to vote even if you wanted to. I mean, that particularly angers me, because lots of kids come out of care and they haven't got family to look after them, that's why they're in care, but they're not going to be able to get any housing benefits. So where are they going to end up?
Disenfranchised. And it angers me as well. I mean, Lot Lees is one of those areas which is a mixed economy, you might say, and there are a lot of very poor people living there. And those are the people least likely to vote. And they are disillusioned, disenchanted. And, of course, the only way you can change things under our current system is to vote, basically. Mm. And we will do our best to try and support them and help them. But, you know, we are living through a period of great divisiveness. It concerns me a lot that people, you know, the poorest are pitched against the poorest, arguing over scraps.
Well, you say that, but also the Labour Party is divided against itself, isn't it? I mean, divisiveness within your own... I mean, you're supposed to be Her Majesty's opposition, and yet it's quite a lot of energy from all Labour councillors and Labour members, as well as MPs, seems to be into fighting in their own party.
Actually, I'm pleased to say that here in Bristol, we're not divided, we're actually pretty united. And one of the things that kind of cheers me a bit is that we are doing things, we're getting on with things. When I see the kind of national landscape, of course, it's not particularly cheering. But here in Bristol, notwithstanding the issue of the enormous deficit, the fact that we are building houses, the fact that we are getting transport sorted out, the fact that we are seeking to make a more equal society in this city, which is itself quite a divided society.
I just want to check, are you 100% behind Jeremy Corbyn?
I didn't vote for Jeremy, but he is our leader, and I think he's a good man whose principles are extremely sound.
Do you think he can win the next general election?
Who knows? It rather depends on when it is, doesn't it, actually? It's quite possible it might be a snap election, I don't know. But we'll have to wait and see. A lot of things will change between now and, say, 2020.
OK, also another bit of news this week. Stubborn John Platt's full statement as he vows to plead not guilty. He's lost the Supreme Court battle over term time holidays for his children. Mr Platt also thanked his wife Sally for putting up with this lunacy as he spoke outside the UK's highest court earlier this week. Dad lost his epic legal battle for the right to take his daughter out of school, says he's absolutely no intention of pleading guilty. Martin, what do you make of this? Is it right for, if parents can take their children on a holiday, which might itself be incredibly educational, that they get fined?
Well, I think it's got to be the case that it's got to be the same rules for everybody. Let's put it that way. He can't be allowed to do it and other people not. So that's I think what the substance of the.
But
of
I mean, surely parents give their children to a school to do the education. It's not the other way around. It's almost as if the schools are assuming that children are their property to do what they want.
You'll understand that the way it works, because of the fact that they've got to have children in schools, the prices of things like holidays are priced accordingly, and you can get cheaper holidays if you do it in term time.
But so you're broadly in favour of fining parents?
No. What I said, it's got to be the same for everybody. So if we decide that anybody can take children out to go on holiday...
Which is the way it used to be, yeah.
Then that's fine. And if we decide that they're not, then that's got to be the same for everybody as well. Because, of course, it has implications, yeah? And don't forget, many poor people don't go on holidays at all.
No. The main problem is the price of holidays during the school holidays, basically. Clearly, the travel companies are putting the prices up very steeply because they know that people are kind of over a barrel. They have to pay it.
It's demand, yeah.
I mean, you look at the price of a holiday in, you know, the kind of quiet season compared to mid-July or mid-August. It's enormous. So I understand why people do take their children on a holiday in term time. I can't say I agree with it, because I think that, you know, it's quite important that children do get educated, and it's the school's job to educate them. The school has a responsibility to do that.
But don't parents give their children, as I said to Martin, isn't it something that you do with your children? You send them to school because you want them to be there, but there is, at the end of the day, that's your decision. A lot of parents decide to home educate, for example, don't they, that to not send their children to school.
Well, some parents wouldn't send their children to school at all, often the very poorest, but that's not acceptable, is it?
Well, this is not what we're talking about here. Anyway, Estella, would you just answer that about, you know, whether that in that sort of situation, if you can take your children to do something educational for the day, and also about home educating kids.
Yeah, well, obviously, if you choose to home educate, then that's your prerogative, and then you can take your children on holiday whenever you want to. But I think it seems to me you have a contract with a school, basically. So you and the school have agreed that they will educate your child, and then to take the child out of school at a time when the school is attempting to do that is obviously quite a problem. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the parents. I can see why they do it. But at the end of the day, you know, rules are rules about these sorts of things.
Okay. On the wider, I suppose, wider educational questions, how do you think it's all going with the introduction of more of these free schools and academies and the reduction in the role of the local authorities?
Yeah, local authorities don't have the same kind of powers or influence in schools that they used to. I am not a particular fan of a free school model, but that is the model we have at the moment, and we have to work with it.
Martin?
Well, you know my views. I'm completely opposed to free schools and academies, but you've got to work with whatever rubbish the government comes up with. Unnoticeably, of course, the idea that all schools are going to be academies has been kicked into touch by the Tory local authorities because they're not happy with it either. I think I was one of the last generations to do the 11 plus, and the 11 plus, for all of its faults, was relatively objective. What you've now got is a dog's breakfast, where schools can basically select what they their own pupils, particularly if they're in prosperous areas, and what's left for those that are not in prosperous areas is increasingly under threat. And you know, in the long run, the Finns have the best results in Europe. They're in the top five in the world. But in Finland, they don't try to teach children to read or write before the age of seven. They never have. It's not like a 60s thing. Same as the rest of Scandinavia. There's no exams or tests until you're 18. And then you do a big exam which decides which direction you're going to go in. Their kids are far superior to our kids. And I've been working in infant schools in the last 3 years, and frankly, some of the stuff that they're doing with the under sevens is inappropriate for the age group.
What, for example?
Well, they're basically being given what is effectively a journalism course when they can barely string a sentence together.
Well, give us an idea of the sort of exactly, you know, a bit more detail of what the children are being asked to do.
Well, do you know what a split digraph is, Tony?
No idea.
Well, I'll tell you what, my five-year-old kids, they know what a split digraph is. It's what we used to call a silent E. So they not only have to learn to say the E on the end of the word pine instead of pin and so on, they've got to know the technical term split digraph. And if they don't know the technical term split digraph, then they get marked down. Age seven, and you don't know it. How old are you?
Never you mind.
Ah, well, this is the problem, isn't it?
And
of course, the other thing that really gets me about it, Tony, is they keep changing what the kids are supposed to know. So we used to call things, at one stage we were calling things like and, but, whatever, connectives, and now they're called conjunctions, or was it the other way around? Now, if a kid uses the wrong word, connective for conjunction, then they get marked down.
I mean,
in actual fact, a connective and a conjunction are the same thing.
These are junior,
but if they use the wrong
these
word...
These are junior school age kids, surely.
Yes, this is infant school. They are now... In Finland, Denmark and all the rest of it, they'd be playing in the sandpit and learning how to get on with other kids, doing art, going out for nature walks. But in Britain, because that's the way we've always done it, we start them early on, fast feeding them all of this stuff. And I particularly...
It sounds like a good reason to take your kid out of school.
Well, indeed.
Take them on holiday.
Take them to Finland.
Well, yes, but the Finns have far better results than we do. And we're trying to copy... You know what they're doing now? They're going to copy the maths books used in China, because they think that that will... If we copy the Chinese maths books, then our kids will be able to do better at maths. And I feel like saying, well, why not go the whole hog and have the maths books in Chinese? Because then they'd really have to... That would really challenge them, wouldn't it?
Chinese, the language of the future, kids. Anyway...
On education, one thing that's concerning me, actually, is I don't know if you know that the government is changing the funding formula. It is going to hit every single school in the country, which will lose thousands of pounds out of its annual income. And this has had hardly any reporting on the main mainstream media.
Thanks
it's
for
extremely
bringing it up.
Concerning.
Yeah, what we'll do also is we'll put a link up to the website where you can put in your postcode and see what's happening to the funding in your local schools.
Good idea, because they're all being affected by this.
On our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And we're going to be talking about it a bit after the 6 o'clock news, but I thought I'd get your take, Estella, also on the unilateral action without legal authorisation. That's what your leader is calling this action last night, bombing Syria from Donald Trump with 59 cruise missiles. I worked out a value of about $100 million worth of cruise missiles flew across and bombed an airfield. Luckily, no Russians who were on the airfield were killed last night.
Well, to be honest, the thing that concerns me most of all is that Trump is completely erratic and actually has no vision and no programme for foreign policy. It's not unusual for American presidents to be effectively voted in on domestic policy and then have to deal with a crisis immediately linked to foreign policy, which is often their comeuppance. But, you know, last week he was Vladimir Putin's best friend, and we know that Putin is good friends with Assad. Last night he made a kind of unilateral decision. It looks like it was in the middle of the night, which is when he seems to make these kinds of decisions, to press the button on this. It's extremely concerning to me. I think that, you know, it's an impetuous action. We don't yet know what the long-term consequences will be. There's no doubt at all that the situation in Syria is extremely serious.
Well, Trump will say, I'm sure, that a very strong message needs to be sent to President Assad of Syria, that there must be no use of chemical weapons in his country.
But I think that needed multilateral agreement.
Well, I mean, I tend to agree with that. I mean, the fact is that it's not even clear who actually carried out this attack. The White Helmets and the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which are the source of these video pictures that we've seen, have the previous attack in 2012, Seymour Hersh, Carla Del Ponte, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, all came to the conclusion that it was the rebels, the Al-Nusra Front, that had used chemical weapons in order to try and trick the Americans into fighting, and that the sarin was actually from Libya and have been supplied by MIT.
A lot of the blame,
the Turkish intelligence.
I think we can put a lot of the blame in Syria actually at the door of the mainstream press, because there's not been a lot of good. I mean, these investigative reports and Carla Del Ponte from the UN's reports not been spoken of at all this week on the mainstream press. And another thing I'd like to just point out is the EU regulators have just approved Rupert Murdoch's Sky TV takeover without any conditions today. I mean, I find it incredible that there doesn't seem. I mean, Donald Trump is doing this in the United States too. Is he campaigned on this too much fake news agenda? And one of the first things he's done is he's got the Federal Communications Commission to say, oh, we're getting rid of the rules about TV station ownership. So it seems that the media is coming together, you know, stations are merging, Murdoch's taking over even more, and none of the politicians seem to want to take the media on.
It's difficult, isn't it? If you were to take the media on, then, you know, often your voice is if you are opposed to some aspects of media, then it's very difficult to get your voice heard. So Trump is a distinctive figure, shall we say. I think the way in which he manipulated news and knowledge during his campaign was appalling. I'm very concerned about the way in which some sense of evidence-based understanding is disappearing in favour of prejudice.
Yes, Martin, the EU regulators are set to approve Rupert Murdoch's £11.7 billion, that's £11.7 billion, takeover of Sky TV with no conditions.
Well, I mean, he's too powerful already, and he's getting even more power.
OK, time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock now, and thanks to our guest Labour councillor for Lockleys, Estella Ticknell.
Thank you.
We have the Westminster Bridge attack and Syria after the news.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the sky.